Yes, please turn to Matthew 18. We're gradually approaching the text. Really what we've done so far is just simply approach it so that we begin to see the richness that's within it. If you take the text simply by itself without the books, the context, the structure and so on, obviously there's a vast amount that you lose or you don't see. It's these different layers and different dimensions when it comes to interpretation that opens up, and we begin to see that in the simplest of remarks there is a sense of great depth that the Lord is saying. The profundity of the Lord is terrific, but at the same time, of course, it's put over in simple language. And I suppose that's the attractiveness of our Lord's teaching. It sounds simple, but it's deep and profound. Now, in the previous chapter 17, we've seen how the whole of the section runs up to teaching concerning the church. But in particular, I'd just like you to notice that in chapter 17 and verse 22, they were gathered together in Galilee. Jesus said to them, "Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, be raised on the third day," and they were deeply grieved. Then comes this story of the fishing and catching the fish with the tax money in its mouth, both for Jesus and for Peter. There's obviously a very clear emphasis. It's the only miracle that the Lord did for himself, and even that he did half for somebody else. And so this union, this relationship, is what is being emphasized in the story. Well, the story itself was just a challenge of everyday life. You get your tax coming through every now and again. I got the electric bill this morning. That's why I'm a bit late trying to recover. But as you look at these things as they come in, then it's the opportunity the Lord takes to minister to us and to say something to us and to teach us something. The thing he wants to teach out of this is the relationships are at the base of everything that's going to be built. You see, just earlier in chapter 16, Jesus has said, "You are Peter, and on this rock," and I take it to mean, in the light of how Peter uses it in chapter 2 of his epistle, I take it to mean it's the confession, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," that on this rock I will build my church. And Jesus has been building on that confession. We're a confessional church. We confess Christ is Lord. And as he builds on that, the church comes into being. Like Solomon building his temple, now Jesus, the greater Solomon, is building something greater out of our lives. So on the basis of that relationship that comes, "You are the Christ, flesh and blood has not revealed it to you, but my Father who is in heaven," the Lord begins to draw things together. Now that, of course, just lays the basis of what the church is. The church isn't a union, it isn't a society, it isn't that which has voting rights and tries to get to some sort of consensus. It is a shared life. It is a relationship. A relationship is basically a shared life. A relationship is where you give and you take, where you receive and where you give. And it is really the definition of life. In John chapter 17, Jesus says, "This is life eternal, it's to know God and Jesus Christ whom he has sent." Life is knowing, and it is being in a sharing relationship with. You might say the life of the flowers out there is that they have the ability to give to the ground and to take from the ground. And in that two-way flow, then a relationship exists between the plant and the earth and the chemicals in the earth, and it grows and it's alive. Take it out of that relationship, no earth, it will die. Similarly, animals in their habitats and human beings, we live by our relationships. And even within God, you see, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are continuously giving and receiving and giving and receiving. So that in that beautiful way that I think it was Hilary, the early church father, who first brought the idea out, but the Celtic church also took it up. It's the idea of in the Trinity, there is like a three-way dance going on all the time. Because when you're dancing, you see you move forward and your partner moves backward. That's pretty easy when you're thinking of twos. It's more difficult when it's threes. But you all have your part to play of giving and taking, and giving and taking. You're moving in and out of each other's lives. And it's that that's going on within the Godhead. Now, if we're going to have a church which is reflecting what the Godhead is, it's got to be a church which first and foremost is based on relationships. And there's that flow and life of giving and taking, giving and taking. This is life eternal, is to know God and Jesus Christ, whom he has sent. There is a giving and a taking and a giving and a taking. So that, I think, I don't want to, you know, I'd love to go off actually, but I mustn't, talking about the Trinity and the life flow that goes on there. That's at the basis of this statement which precedes the more obvious teaching concerning the church. But I've tried to emphasize we mustn't disassociate this story coming after the telling of the cross is going to come, then this story, and now we move into church life. You put the cross on the basis, you come together in your relationships, then you can begin to share and live together. See the steps? I've got to go and I've got to die, then the story of the tax man coming and go and pay for you and me, and then the teaching about the church is a logical sequence. Put the cross in the middle of the people of God, on the ground, I'm thinking, because that's our foundation, and on the foundation of the cross we come together and our relationships start to be built, and you're building relationships which always require a cross in the middle. It's always dismaying in the 20th century to find that Christianity is often interpreted in terms of you just simply do what you want to do and what you feel you should do. And there's never any point where if the head says to my body, keep running a bit harder, my body says, I don't want to, but it still does it. That's the relationship between the head and the body. The relationship between Christ and the church, whenever we get to a point these days when it's hard going and we don't want to do it, we say, well, it can't be of the Lord because I don't feel like doing it. It doesn't give me any pleasure doing it. Or even more subtly, Pharisaically, we teach it must be the law. I'm not under law because I don't want to do it. It must be the law that says I've got to do it. You know this sort of thing? Well, I just want to make a suggestion to you. We've never learnt to obey the Lord until we don't want to do it. Because if you always want to do it, if you always want to do it, you've all got nice feelings about doing it and all the rest of it, and therefore you're only obeying yourself, really. You're only obedient to your master when you don't want to do it. Now, thank God a lot of the time we do want to do it. In our better moments, in our love for him and our relationship with him, yes, okay, we've got a heart and a mind that's his way. But there must be times, there must be moments when we don't want to do it, but we do find that we've got to obey, and that's the thing that is the challenge in our lives. In this relationship at the basis of everything, and the cross at the basis of our body life, then we can begin to think seriously about the church. But without that, without the cross, without I don't want to do it, without that pain that comes in relationships, then we really haven't got church life at all. It's bound to be pain. That's why one of the words used here in verse 27 is, but lest we give them offence. Now, I know, of course, it's offence to Jewish tax collectors, which I'll talk about in a moment, but that it's very interesting that even with conservative interpreters, I'm sorry to make a meal out of this, but even with conservative interpreters, they come along and say, well, verse 24-27, that's not there in Mark's gospel, it slips in between the statement about going to the cross, and so it's really out of place. He's just sort of thrown it, you know, as though Matthew was absolutely bone-idle and lazy. Oh, I've got a story here, where shall I throw it? Let's throw it in there. You know, that's the way they talk, forgetting even that the Holy Spirit is supposed to be, according to our doctrine, putting the book together. Every word is breathed from the Spirit of God. This is in its right place because God's put it there. And I think if we don't come with that high doctrine of the scriptures, we won't get high teaching. We won't get very shallow stuff. And it's there for a purpose. And so the next step, you'll find this, you'll find it in conservative commentaries. I'm sorry, but you will. Ken knows, he's read a lot on Matthew. But you get the little word there, verse 27, but lest we give them offence, lest we stumble them. Now look down in verse 6 of chapter 18. That little, lest we stumble them, is in preparation for causes for these little ones to stumble. Verse 7, because of its stumbling blocks, its inevitable stumbling blocks must come, through whom stumbling blocks come. Verse 8, stumbling. And verse 9 again, causes you to stumble. Seven times, including that first one, up in verse 27. Seven times the word stumble. Surely, as this introductory story takes us into the teaching about the church, it introduces the word to us, stumbling, giving offence and taking offence. Why? Because if you know anything about church life, that is fundamental to it. Because church relationships, and if you've got a church without relationships, you've got people sitting in pews, never actually have any relationships, you go, okay, you avoid it. Wonderful church life, but it isn't church life. And when you begin to open up and you're vulnerable, of course, we start to hurt one another. That's why the cross is the groundwork. That's why the cross comes first, because it's on the basis of the cross that we are learning how to have relationships together, even if they hurt, because the cross hurt. Okay? You know, I'm never going to get to chapter 18 like this. But that's how you build the church. I will build my church. Here's the Lord doing it. He's not going to say, I build my church in chapter 16 and forget all about it. We're getting to the place now, he's just teaching us how he's going to do it. And although, as I say, it's the tax collectors, it says, lest we give them offence, it's of course the whole business of giving offence to anybody. It's giving offence even to fellow church members. And it's a hurtful thing to be in the church. And therefore, if we don't learn the cross at the basis of it, we're never going to enter into the joy of its life. But I'm emphasizing that because in the 20th century, as we're nearly in the 21st, everything has got to be hunky-dory, it's got to be sweet, we've got to enjoy it. Once a little bit of pain comes along, oh, we're going to join somewhere else or opt out altogether and never engage in church life, because it's much easier, and don't take this as a quote, it's much easier to be a Christian floating around not belonging to any body of people, because it doesn't hurt. There's no stumbling, there's no giving offence. It's dead easy. But when we're together and committed together, then it's painful. But then that's a part of the pain out of which joy comes. No pain in childbirth, no joy as the child is born. And it's a part of that. Okay? And it's a part of that, and that's how we learn and grow and become more like Jesus. Don't you think day by day by day by day Jesus felt pain with his disciples? And he just bursts out on one occasion, and I don't believe it's sinful, I don't believe it's denigrating his character, but 10 times he says, how is it you don't believe? Why is it that you didn't understand? Did you not see that? And he says 10 times in this great long list, as though he's absolutely frustrated with them. Have I been with you so long and still? So there is pain in the relationships with us and with each other. But it's building something. It's building something which is going to be more and more and more wonderful as the centuries of eternity roll on. And it's going to be worthwhile. And at the rock bottom is that you might say, if you build on other people's blood, like dictators and military commanders, then the empire will fall. If you build on your own blood, like Jesus does, then eventually there's something that won't come down. All right. Well, sorry about that. Let's all go and join the Communist Party, I think. If you don't want pain. I've really got to go fast. I'm awfully sorry. Verse 24. When they'd come to Capernaum, they collected the 2 drachma tax. Now, that was based upon the silver, the 2 drachma, or the equivalent in the Hebrew. I've forgotten what it was now. Is it the mina? Anyway. In the book of Exodus, where they paid the atonement money, and the atonement money was used for the things in the tabernacle. Now that might have been a one-off, but the Pharisees decided against the Essenes. The Essenes only wanted it as a one-off. They wanted to introduce it every year, and so they said every year we have to pay this tax in order to keep the temple running. And that's what was going on, and this is what the man has come for. Rabbis and priests didn't have to pay the tax, but the ordinary people did. So does your master pay tax is a very reasonable question for the tax collectors for the temple. This is nothing to do with the Romans, nothing to do whether we should pay Caesar or not. This is the temple tax to keep the temple running. Now that's significant to begin with, because if we are the new temple, the church, what's going to keep us running? What do we have to pay to keep the church going? I don't mean just financially, I mean we pay for it with life, with our very substance of our being. And when they'd come to Capernaum, those who collected the 2 drachma tax came to Peter and said, does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax? He said, yes. And when he came into the house, and we thought about this, Jesus spoke to him first, interrupted him, what do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs and poll tax? From their sons or from strangers, from aliens? On this saying, from strangers, Jesus said to him, consequently, the sons are free. There's only two other verses, and they're both together in chapter 8 of John's Gospel, where Jesus uses the word freedom. Interesting, but there it is. there's a quote, of course, come to set captives free, but here's one of the cases, they are free from paying. So there is a sense in which grace is at the basis of all that we're doing. That's why we're going to talk about children in a moment, because that's what chapter 18 is about, isn't it, at the beginning. You can't get into this life together unless you're like a child, and you will not inherit the kingdom, and you will not use the kingdom unless you're a child. And children are there exactly and totally and completely and utterly by grace. If the parents hadn't given the child life, the child wouldn't be there. And if the child is going to live, the mother has by grace to give it milk. If the child's going to grow up, the father ought by grace to be giving it the security and the wherewithal for its growth and life. The whole thing is utterly by grace. And we're to be seen, therefore, as grace recipients, children. That is what the church is brought up from. So the Lord interrupts Peter and says, who do they take it from? And when he says, of course, he takes it from aliens, not from the sons, so the sons are free. Jesus, again, is interpreting the law, or even changing it. If it was intended it was to be an annual one, he's changing it. Have you noticed how he changes it with ceremonials, as he said, making all meats clean? Notice how he changes it with the Sabbath. I am the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath. And he interprets it his own way. And that is one of the sure signs of the claim that Jesus is making to be superior to the Torah, because he gave it in the first place. And which, of course, is fundamental to our understanding of who our Lord is. And here he is doing it again. He's giving the interpretation. You've heard it said of old times, this, this, and this. But I say to you, and he's saying here, I say to you that you don't have to pay that tax for the temple. You are not under that law. I'm interpreting for you now on a totally different level. What you have to give is simply yourselves to build a new sort of temple, not one made with material things. But since you're free and the king doesn't take tax from you, it gives you a certain status. You've got the status, first of all, of sons. But notice we've only got the status of sons of the king by our relationship with the king, with Jesus. And if we've got a status of a son because we're related to Jesus, like Peter's going to have to pay the tax for both of them, they're related together, you might say, then that gives us a relationship with each other. And that relationship with each other is that we are brothers and sisters, because we're all sons and daughters in the kingdom. And that is the view in which we begin to try and understand who we are as the church. We've got relationships are painful, the cross is at the basis of them, however, they are relationships of a family. The Lord, it does not overly stretch the symbolism of a family, has a little bit here and a little bit there, but here it is again. The Church of Jesus Christ is a family. Why? Because we get on like brothers and sisters? No. In the first place, we're a family because we've got a relationship with the King. We are sons and daughters, therefore, secondly, we're brothers and sisters. It's not that we're brothers and sisters, therefore, we are related to the King. It's the other way around. That's why Jesus begins and says, with Peter, just two chapters before, when Peter says, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God, flesh and blood's not revealed it to you, my Father in heaven, there's a relationship, I see who you are, Lord, and the Lord knows me, and on this rock I will build my church. They're going to get others like that, but they're going to come together and get relationships amongst themselves, because they've got a relationship with me. So the church is beginning to come to view. However, says Jesus, grace is at the base of it. The relationship of sons of the King are at the very heart of it. Notice the King, because the kingdom of heaven is going to come into the next chapter. And in verse 27, lest we give offence. The church, first, if you like, well, not first definition, because we've had a few descriptions already. But to the church, the maintenance of the church, the keeping of the church in what it should really be, is a people of not giving offence, a people of no offence. That's our ideal. All right? Lest we give them offence. Lest we give each other offence, which is the most immediate ground where pain will happen, but unless we give the world offence. Now, of course, there is the offence of the cross. That can't be avoided. the offence of the gospel as it goes out into the world. But if we are giving offence because we are lazy, irresponsible, downright arrogant, or whatever, then obviously we are not fulfilling the charge that the Lord makes. But even more so, it's going out of our way to take the ground of offence, the possibility of offence, away. There is no need. We have rights. But if our rights give us an arrogance and a superiority, and we put down those who are around us, then of course we're entering into a place where the world will take offence at us. And the Lord says, isn't it worth just losing a little bit of money in order not to give offence? Doesn't that happen? Aren't there times when we have to make up our minds, well, I've got a right for this. Why are these people, they're cheating me or whatever? I'm not saying I'm giving you an answer for every situation. I'm just saying there is this possibility all the time. How much do we go along with the world walking over us, cheating us or whatever, or taking something from us, and we've got a right to have it back, but we don't, because for goodness sake, we don't want to give offence. And there are lots of little nitty-gritty. There are some people who are so pedantic and so sort of hyped up as to what their rights are, they are forever causing problems around them. Let it drop. That isn't just laid back, and you know, there's something godly about it. We don't want to give offence. It's going to cost you something. You shouldn't have to pay it. You are sons of the King. However, let's do this so that they don't misunderstand us, because they will otherwise. So that is the attitude of the church, a people who, at bottom line, are not here to give offence. We're trying to do everything possible not to give offence. And the Lord, the Spirit, will show you where to draw the line. It's not always obvious, and we mustn't criticise each other for it, but there is a line that He will draw. You remember the Lord says, turn the other cheek, but He didn't literally Himself. To turn the other cheek is a description of a man or a woman filled with the Spirit. Standing before the Sanhedrin, Jesus didn't offer the other cheek and say, hit me on the other one. He just protested and said, well, you know, passively protested, you didn't have a right for that, to do that to me. It was, breaking the law. But he didn't insist on his rights, just pointed them out. And that's the difference again about the giving of offence. Well, that could go a long way too, so you can think more about it. It's significant, I think, that atonement money was what was used to keep the temple going, because we've just seen about the atonement on the story before. We have to know, of course, the background of Judaism to know that's what it is. It's the atonement money. But it's the atonement money when it says, give it for you and me. The little word there is a substitutionary word. It's the word anti, in the place of you and me. So the atonement money, of course, was in the place of the firstborn son, or for the individual, actually, in that case, but sometimes it was the firstborn. And the atonement money was in the place of, a substitution for, and the substitution word anti is thrown in there for you and me. And there's a substitution in the building of the church. There's a substitution in this new temple that's coming up. We thought a little bit about it yesterday, and that price been paid. Now, how are we going to get it? It's in the fish, it's in the fish's mouth, and it's rather a nice story. Always encourages me when it comes to paying tax time, that maybe the Lord's got special ways to get me through. And a little bit of fishing is rather a novel way of dealing with the problem. That's no excuse, of course, to spend waste hours and hours. I've never really got into fishing. R.T. Kendall's got a fishing trophy in his study. I thought, goodness me, if it was for catching Christian fish, I would be, you know, spiritual enough. But it's, and he goes off fishing with, what's the other guy who goes fishing? Is it Lyndon Bowring? I think it is. Wouldn't believe it. Anyway, I went fishing once, fell asleep, caught nothing. Anybody like fishing? That's enough of all that. No, there you are. Okay, that's right. Yeah.
You might think you're wasting your time.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's just simply, you need a little sort of education or something. And you'd love it. Sorry. That's very unfair of me. Come on then. on the basis of this introduction, we're ready to move on into verse 1. At that time. Okay? At that time. The disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who then is the greatest thing?" Incidentally, I just throw this in. It's interesting, going back. I'll never get there, will I? Isn't it interesting? Jesus says, "Go and catch that fish and then pay for us," and that. He doesn't pay for the upkeep of the temple with his own charity money that's been given to him, you know, the women who kept them alive and with their substance and so on. Just a thought about how we use our money. Yeah, I'll just throw that out. It was, some special gift. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Because quite obviously, they have interpreted what he said in terms of status. We've got a status. We are the sons of the king. And so how people can then just simply dismiss this little run-up story and say, well, it's been slipped in by some lazy scribe who decided it's nice to throw the story in there. And, you know, the old scissors and paste method. Cut out a story here and stick it in there. And because you've got a bit dozy around about 10 o'clock and you've stuck bits out of place. But it doesn't matter much. It's all the New Testament and we can trust it. I don't think I could trust too much of that. But here is the story which has led up to, I've got a status. What is my status? If I'm in relationship with Jesus and I'm a part of the church, my status is that of a son of the king. They don't pay taxes. However, we'll do it because we don't want to give offence. We want to stand with the world. Paul had a right to live by the gospel, but he made tents instead. We have a right to be meat eaters in the midst of vegetarians. And we've got to accept one another and put up with each other on these matters. We have a right to not have holy days, but some people like holy days, so we, you know, we put up with Christmas and don't write tracts against it. Why? Because we are living together in relationship with one another. Okay. Matter of fact, I quite like Christmas. And I've never got over. You know, you remember one time everybody was quoting somebody going around the place saying, "God hates Christmas. God says I hate Christmas." I wish I did, if that was the case, because I don't. Perhaps it's one of those things I've got to learn a bit of pain about. But I love it, with all the kids come round and everything's different and bright, and we still put, you know, even my grown-up children complain if we don't have a Christmas tree. They're miseries, really, but there you are, they insist on it. And we have all the lot, including wicked old Christmas pudding and all these things. I like it. So feast days and vegetarians and so on. Paul argues the same case there, don't give offence. But verse 1, at that time, who then is the greatest in the kingdom? If we're all sons and daughters, which is the greatest one? Who's the firstborn son? Who's the chief? And they've immediately begun to switch in to the way that the world thinks about status. Now, we are to honour one another. We are to honour Caesar because of his status, not because he's a nice man. But to honour him because of his status. And this is something which, since the French Revolution, we find it very hard to take on board. Since the Enlightenment, you see, emphasising each individual, we've lost the concept of the need for structure and for status in society in order that it might be glued and held together. It's an inevitable part of the secular world. You can't do without it. And people who are just simply anarchical have never really understood that they are a parasite upon order. You can't have anarchy unless there is order to sustain that. It's like drug scene and so on is the basis of a lot of anarchy, but you need very sophisticated structures to produce the drugs and a very superior way of distribution. You've got order in society in order that anarchy can be bred and can take place. So it's always a parasite. And so people who are forever and ever, you know, we don't want any status and all the rest of it, and I'm as good as you, Jack, and I better not be too naughty. So we'll be Tony Blair and the classless society. It is ridiculous. It does not and never will exist. If it does, we'll all be in anarchy. And it's a right and a proper and a good thing to show respect to magistrates, to the police, and so on, even if they're a wicked old bunch, and they probably are, because there's a wicked old human beings. But otherwise it's chaos. And chaos and anarchy, the weakest pay the price. Yeah. Not the tough boys, they get away with it anyway. So there's some degree of order, and that requires status. And we can't avoid it. Jesus, in the end, is not saying totally statusless, because he's turning the thing round and says, oh yes, there is a status, there is a greatest in the kingdom. So there is a status, isn't there? Because the greatest is as this little child. So you've always got to have some recognition of order. And we should pay respect and honour to one another. That isn't the point. It's whether I am seeking to accrue honour to me. Not where I'm responsible, give it to somebody else. It's whether I'm insisting on getting it to me. Get the point? And that's the issue that's now going to arise, and Jesus will meet it with this very startling illustration. Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven at this time? He called a child to himself and set him in the midst of them. And that child, set in the midst of the disciples, put there by Jesus, puts Jesus in the midst of them. Because if you just read on into verse 20, for where two or three are gathered in my name, there am I in their midst, you have the same phrase, exactly the same phrase as you got in verse 2. He called the child to himself and set him before them, or in the midst, if you look in the margin of the New American Standard Bible. It's exactly the same phrase. So for Jesus to get into the midst of his disciples, he puts this statusless child, and then he's in the midst. And if we want a church in which Jesus is found in the midst of us, two or three met in my name, the easiest way to do it is to put the least status person in the midst, or to make room, because in a minute we're going to find if you receive such as that, you see Jesus, because he doesn't let go of them. He comes with him. And that's the way to minister to each other. Because in the end, I don't want you, you don't want me, you want Jesus. So when you have me, if I don't bring Jesus with me, you're not getting really what you need. Okay? If I only bring me with me, oh grief, it's him again. If I bring Jesus with me, that's left behind as well, then that's church life. That's church life. But if everybody in this room, sorry to be particularly pointed, but if we're all looking to try to get some sort of status and honour from each other, you won't find Jesus in the midst. But if we're all seeking to be like little children, honouring others but not looking for it for ourselves, then the Lord will have room. And you look around and say, there's the least honourable one. Like Francis of Assisi said, why did God use him so much? Simply because he looked around for the most useless and helpless and hopeless and unblessed and ungifted person, and he said, that's the one I can use. Alright? But we haven't got too many churches like that, have we? Sorry about this, and I'm not knocking at any particular denominations. Including, I might be knocking at Ichthus, but do you know why a lot of people don't join up with the new churches? We haven't got a career structure. So you can't increase in honour as the years go on, getting a bigger pension and greater title. That's why, I don't say therefore it solves all the problems, it doesn't. You just have an inverted one or a hidden one or something like that. So it doesn't solve the problem, but I'm using it as a concrete illustration to try and help us to see what it means to take a position. Of course, there are those, for instance, in the established church who have insisted, like Handley Mole, who said, if ever I become a bishop, please write and tell me that I'm backslidden. But what he's getting at is, he knew in his heart of hearts, whether he became a bishop or not is irrelevant, he knew in his heart of hearts that is the position, that is the way of the little child. Not looking, not seeking status. You see the idea? So it's not so much the outward structure, but it does symbolise something. And the symbolism very often is that if I'm going to be a greater and a greater and greater Christian, I will become more and more and more obscure and become less and less and less recognised or honoured. And Jesus put it in another way, using exactly the same word for humble in the verse 23 of in chapter 23 of Matthew, when he says that to he that is takes the place of the humility and is the servant of all, he is the greatest, who is the servant of all. Here it's the child who is the greatest. That is, if you like, another way of defining the church, not only the community of no offence, but it's also the community of the insignificant. Community of the insignificant, or the insignificance. He called a child, set him in the midst of them, and said, "Truly I say to you, unless you are converted," or unless you turn, converted, to turn, to return, the Old Testament word sub is the same word, is that behind the word metanoia here, to turn, to repent, to be converted, become like children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Now notice verse 3, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Verse 4, whosoever therefore humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Verse 5, and whosoever receives one such child in my name receives me. Now there are three different things there in relationship to being like little children. One, you will not enter the kingdom. Two, you will not be the great, you will be the least in the kingdom. Three, that you bring, if you like, the king himself. If you receive one such child, you receive me. So you bring the kingdom, or you bring the king. There are three distinct things. Don't roll them all into some sort of misty confusion. You know, we've all got to be like children. It's not even being like children. It's being in the status of children. It isn't childlike qualities. I know lots of children who are not very humble. Is that right? They're very arrogant and, you know, must get their own way. Not the character of the child. It's that when we humble ourselves, we take the status of the child. And the status of the child, according to Jeremiah, I think we should pronounce him, is that in those days, the deaf, the blind, I think it was, and the imbecile were on the same status as the child. And if you think that, haven't we developed and civilizedly grown for the last 2,000 years, think again. It is the children who in the end, from the womb right through until they're grown up and start to fight for themselves, who in our societies today all over the world are the ones without any status. You just remove them in the womb, they haven't got so much as "how's your father?" And when they're born, they are abused physically, sexually, emotionally. I mean, the courts are full of it all the time. No wonder our taxes are so high, to keep the courts going with it all. And the children are the ones who are dismissed. It's regarded as though you haven't got any claims at all. Your property, or else you're just ignored. Anyway, you're down there, so I don't see you. I just walk over you. And I think that anybody who's any sensitivity at all as to where the human race is in the world as a whole, you may not think it's the case down your street until something shocking happens, but that children are counted as virtually nothing. They're just the playthings or the things to be misused by adults. And society hasn't really changed at all. It's no different than they regarded it in the Jewish society. The children were on the same level as imbeciles. As far as rights were concerned, they had none. Now, of course, there are all sorts of things happening trying to rectify it, that man's legality is not going to change it. Saying that a, you know, 6-year-old child can take his parents to court isn't going to change it. It's just simply a matter that we are seeking to live by the world's values and society's values rather than the values of Jesus. Because if we humble ourselves and take the status of a child, we'll start to think like children. We get alongside them. We begin to see their needs. We begin to take them into account. And it isn't sheer sentimentality. Because I notice the politicians aren't even kissing so many children to deceive people these days. They're giving up on it, by and large. But it is real, taking into account that the children are those who we must align with. Put them first. And that is losing our own honour and giving it away to somebody else. So Jesus says you must become as children. Now, in these three different ways. First, verse 3, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Except a man is born again, he cannot see the kingdom, and except a man is born again, he cannot enter the kingdom. You remember I made a point that the church is the instrument of the kingdom, it isn't the kingdom. So if God is going to use us, and we're going to enjoy the life that comes with being used by God, to enter into life as opposed to enter into death, to enter or into Gehenna, into it says in parallelism, or enter into the kingdom as opposed to sitting around never taking up the kingdom authority, power, opportunities to get God's will done on earth. If we're going to enter now and indeed enter the kingdom when it comes in its fullness and the kingdoms of this world become the kingdom of our God and his Christ, if we're going to enter him, we must first of all become like children in being born again. And to be born again means you haven't got any rights on God. God, you've got to get me born again. Nothing of it, nothing's coming out at all. A baby can't say to its prospective father, I want you to get me born, please. He gets born. And all we do is come and we simply are there. And when we've abandoned our rights, God can do it in us. While we hang on to them, he can't. But when we abandon them, nothing in my hand I bring, simply to thy cross I cling. Naked come to thee for dress, helpless look to thee for rest. Foul I to the fountain fly, wash me, Saviour, I die. That is how you got born again. And then you could enter, you could see the kingdom, and if you would, you could enter it. But if you're going to go on entering it and using that kingdom power and authority for the Lord to get his will done on earth as in heaven, if you're going to have that position, that status for entering into the kingdom when Jesus comes again, you must be born again. You must have become like a little child. You become like a little child, God will make you a little child. You become like, you can't get yourself born again, but you can become like being born again. God then does the work and makes you born again. So you become a child, you enter the kingdom. But all the way through our Christian lives is taking the same position. And as we take the same position, that's when the authority and the activity of God continues and moves out. Arrogance, status seeking, you cannot believe me because you seek glory one from another. Terrible thing in Christian work, people seek glory from one and from another. I know deep down we could say, well, I just want a little bit of affirmation, I'm going the right way. And of course we're always affirming everybody these days. Everybody's got to be affirmed, otherwise they have psychological breakdowns. Sorry about that. Well, it used not to be like that. You used to get put down and you still had to get up and go on if you're going to do anything for God. Now you get built up and you get affirmed, and isn't it nice to be affirmed and everybody is affirmed? I'm sure it's right, but I just got a little niggle about it somewhere. That's right. They didn't. If they had it as tough, they might get on a bit better. Anyway, that was... Well, I got that off my chest. Sorry, but I suppose it's relevant. And do we believe the words of God or do we not? When Jesus says, when Paul says, those who are adulterers, those who are homosexual, those who are covetous, they will not enter the kingdom. Is it true? If you are not like a little child, you will not enter the kingdom. You won't enjoy it. You won't share with it. You won't exert it. You won't see the reign of Christ. Number two, whoever therefore humbles himself, that's the same word that we get with Jesus in Philippians 2. He who existed in the form of God didn't count it robbery to hang and grasp at it, but he emptied himself, made himself of no reputation, and he humbled himself and took the form of a servant. And being found in the fashion of a man, he became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore God has highly exalted him and given him the name which is above every name, that the name of Jesus, things in heaven, earth, under the earth, should bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. And that description of the humbling of Jesus, the taking the form of a servant, the being found in the fashion of man, being obedient unto death, the death of the cross, is the pathway which, of course, is in view here. He that humbles himself takes that pathway. He is the one who is the greatest in the kingdom. So we'd never know whether we're the greatest in the kingdom. And notice that little word, one such child, because quite clearly as we move on in this picture, we're not thinking about children, we're thinking about believers who are like children. Verse 6, one of these little ones who believe in me. It's not a little child who believes in me, it's a believer who's taking the position of a little child. Okay. So part C, whosoever receives one such child in my name receives me. So if you receive one of these true disciples who is seeking to be statusless, like a child, who is not seeking honour, who is not putting on airs and graces, who is not making out that they've got something nobody's else got and you're very lucky to have me, but if you take one of those who probably doesn't think he's got an awful lot, but he does love Jesus and there's plenty of room in Jesus for his life and he is not seeking to be anything but simply that, if you receive one of those, you receive Jesus. You receive me. Now that is how the church is built up. That is the living glue that holds people together. The living glue is the life of Jesus himself, who comes to us through our brothers and sisters. And as he comes through our brothers and sisters and we receive one another, we receive Christ. That's a, forgive me, that is a real receiving meeting. We've had plenty enough receiving meetings. This is a real receiving meeting. We're receiving Jesus through each other, because he's carried in those, or he's got his hand on those who are the greatest in the kingdom, who are taking that position. There's more of Christ received by receiving the overlooked, the insignificant, but those who are seeking to take a position where Jesus is. There's receiving more of Jesus there than in all sorts of other things that people do to try and increase their spirituality. Notice it's together. It's not all separated off in some exclusive cave in the desert or some ivory tower in an exclusive university. It's down amongst ordinary people where there are statusless people who are loving Jesus and seeking to be servants and to take no airs and graces and not take anything on themselves. You remember Jesus said, you cannot believe because you seek honour one from another. Cannot believe because you seek honour from another. It's receiving one of those whereby I receive more of Christ and more of Christ and more of Christ. That's where I discover him. I don't like the word sacrament. You get whole books written about it. You get conservative scholars giving in to the jolly word sacrament. I've just got a thing about it. It does irritate me. It isn't a biblical word, except it means oath. But that's not what they mean. It came out of the fact that they used to take an oath at the Lord's table. Not to swear, not to commit adultery, to stand by all their pledges, keep their promises. That was the sacrament at the Lord's table. And it started to be attached to baptism and to the Lord's table. Then it was added to marriage, and you needed the priest to make it happen. You need the priest to make the Lord's table happen. And this sacrament idea, with the idea of it's not sacred, it's sacrament is an oath, but it's being separated away. And then you look at these different things, and it eventually becomes an icon, and that's a sacrament because it's a means whereby grace is ministered to you through that image in the icon. And then it becomes the justification for idols and statues, and we're disobeying the Old Testament, don't let that worry you. We are just sort of, you know, the Ten Commandments. We're finding grace through some earthly means. And basically now, when theologians use this jolly word, they mean that it is a means whereby the earthly opens the door to the heavenly. But in that sense, you see, the whole of life is a sacrament. But particularly the church is a sacrament. Why don't we stick to biblical terminology? It saves us from being too confused at times, and let the Lord's table be what it is. It's a memorial. Do this in memory of me. And baptism is a symbol. It's explained so by Jesus, by Paul, that death, burial, and resurrection is a symbol of identification. Of course it's a means of grace, but you're a means of grace to me. The sunshine's a means of grace to me. Can open the door to the Son of Righteousness to arise with healing. The flowers are a means of grace. The whole of life is a sacrament in that sense, if you want to use it in this confined biblical way. theological way, but it isn't the biblical use of that word. And I tell you what the danger is, that obviously we've got to use words that aren't always in the Bible to describe something, but it starts to gather a meaning around it which goes beyond anything that the scripture might have to say about it. That's the danger. And you read more into it because of its theological history. Verse 5 then, that's receiving from one another. How important then it is that I keep taking and keep humbling and keep in that place where I'm not seeking anything of status, but as a child, I'm dependent. I'm a dependent on grace. I'm a dependent on His holding me up. If He doesn't feed me, I haven't got a chance. If He doesn't help me through, then there's nothing about me. But every person who's come through life as a child has got an awful lot of Jesus, you'll find about them when you receive them. Will bring an awful amount of the kingdom with them and see God's kingdom changing around them. I don't mean you just loads and loads of activity. You get buckets of activity. Buckets of activity in all sorts of ways, but I mean the real kingdom, where it's salting and lighting the earth. These are the people who do it. But then, and we'll have to finish on this note, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, is our stumbling block, giving offence, it is better for him that a heavy millstone were hung around his neck. In fact, it's the donkey millstone, it's got the word donkey in it. So the donkey millstone be hung around the neck, and that he be drowned in the depth of the sea. Anyone who is caused to stumble, despising a little one, counting them as nothing, falling over them and trampling them, it would be far better, it's one of those little ones that believe in me, not the little one himself, may be true, but a little one who believes in me, it's the one who's taken that position. I hope I'm careful enough that you don't need any further explanation, but that is what we're talking about. It's the believer who's taken the position of a little one. It's not, you know, when somebody does something to a child, that a millstone hung about his neck to see, as the popular press would put it over. It's the believer who is truly keeping or taking and accepting the status of a child, in order that we might be a fellowship and a movement and a church together. It's that one, in some way or other, is offended and stumbled. Then it's better that the person who did it was, just not there at all. To hang a millstone around his neck and cast the sea means there's no hope, of course, of survival, but it's to get him out of the way. Woe to the world because stumbling blocks, and it's inevitable stumbling blocks will come, but it is a reminder that the way that we treat one another within the community of Christ, especially those who are seeking to be Christ-like and to follow His instructions, because you're making yourself vulnerable again, aren't you? If you're not going to claim any honour, if you're not going to insist on any honour, you're just going to be trampled over if you're amongst a load of hooligans. And the church very often is a bunch of hooligans, isn't it? Oh.
I know, it's a very respectable one.
But the person who is being damaged, God may, well, as we'll see in a moment, go after them. People will go after them, bring them back and help them. I don't want to sound too negative. It's a trouble finishing on a negative note rather than, you know, hyping everybody up. Say, yeah, that's lovely, wonderful, but we all want to go. But isn't it terrible how many fallen away, clapped out, hurt people are hanging around the edges of the church because they've been hurt by the church? Mm-hmm. Yes. Loads of them. Well, Jesus is just teaching that if you go in for deep living and you make yourself vulnerable, because that's what it is, then there's always the chance of being hurt, and there may be wreckage around. And a lot of those people who have been hurt, offences being caused against them, they are so pained inside that I would say it's the deepest pain you ever come across. It is far deeper than any other hurts. It's hurts that come from church relationships. Well, it takes a long while sometimes to get a person through them. It's because we are looking, we expect. Now, isn't it amazing? Have you noticed this? you go around the world, you suddenly, you meet a Christian somewhere, and you're straight away, you sense in the spirit where you're like brothers, you're helping one another, you're doing things, you know. How could such a thing happen? You'd never be foolish enough to do that if it was, you know, if you weren't a Christian. You'd be on your guard, and you'd be learning some wisdom, and, you know, I need some discernment about this person. But we are so quickly, we open up to each other, because we know that is the way to live. Obviously, a child initially could be very frightened, but children, by and large, are artless in their judgments of people, and so they're wide open and they welcome one another. Now we're all like that, and then we get hurt and we're surprised. All right. Well, that's the church, which is loved by God and is given as a present to His Son. Terribly important to God, the church. So we better try and love it anyway, even if it does do a lot of damage, especially to us. Okay. The people of giving no offense, and the community of the insignificance. Bless you.